The Guardian.
This is the Guardian Books Podcast from the Edinburgh International Book Festival.
I think what counts as being Scottish is constantly being reinvented.
Favourite book by a Scottish writer?
Louise Welsh, I think. The second one, Tamburlaine.
Poems. Poems by Robert Burns.
Imagined Corners by Willowmere.
Well, obviously you've got to say J.K. Rowling, don't you?
The poetry of Robin Robertson is probably less well known than it should be. He's been here at the festival and he's got a sensibility that's quite new.
Elaine DeRollo, if you've ever wondered, can a woman writer do swashbuckling? Then her first novel, The Peach Grows Almanac, is a wonderful evocation of a 19th century that didn't quite happen.
My favourite book by a Scottish writer is The Wasp Factory by Ian Banks.
Do they have to be Scottish? Can they live in Scotland? Can we shall favour count?
For me, it would be John Buchan, Green Mantle. I just think it's the ultimate fabulous escapist read. The closing scene of Green Mantle is one of the most moving cinematic endings of any adventure book.
I recently rediscovered the early novels of William McIlvany, which I love to pieces. They're just such a wonderful evocation of Glasgow in the 1970s, which now looks like it's like reading about the 30s now.
Well, the best book by a Scottish writer I've ever read is Lanark by Alistair Gray, probably.
Ian Banks, Dead Air, which had a nice description of an Audi as a car that looked like a bar of soap.
I love Edwin Morgan poetry. I am a big fan of his work.
I really like The Attack of the Unsinkable Rubber Ducks by Chris Brookmeyer.
My name's Nick Barley and I'm director of the Edinburgh International Book Festival. This year, it was a particularly important year given the election result here in Scotland and the landslide victory for the Scottish Nationalist Party, for us to have a look at literature in Scotland and the way it affects Scottish sense of identity. Already at the festival, we've had some of the great living Scottish writers such as Alistair Gray and William McIlvany, who did so much to express what it felt like to be Scottish 30, 40 years ago, and who've continued to affect the way Scotland feels about itself today. But we've also heard from some of the great contemporary Scottish voices, people who are changing the way we feel about being Scottish today.
Well, we've been hearing the music of James Yorkston in this podcast, and he's here with me at Ian Rankin's house a day before they both share the stage at the book festival. Hi, both of you.
Hello.
Ian, Rebus is a big music fan, isn't he? Have you ever name-checked James in any of the novels?
The problem with Rebus is that, you know, he's a guy who stopped listening to anything after about 1975. All his favourite music is from the 60s and early 70s. Siobhan, his sidekick, who's much younger, she would listen to the music of people like James and King Creosote, Fence Collective, and all this exciting new music that's coming out of Scotland just now. So I need to get her back, really, so that I can start talking about these new bands that Rebus, frankly, wouldn't listen to. They're too young for him.
I was actually in one of the Rebus novels. I was in a book called Flesh Market Close. I think it must be at the end of one of the cases, and he listens to that, Van Morrison, and then Hobo Talk, and then James Yorkston. Hobo Talk were an Edinburgh band way back then, and James Yorkston still is, I guess.
You did promise us that Siobhan was going to come back and star in her own novels, didn't you, a while ago? Is that going to happen?
Did I promise that? She might. I don't know. If the good Lord spares me, everything's possible.
No, Sir James, you're here to talk about your book, which is It's Lovely to Be Here, The Touring Diaries of a Scottish Gent. It gives quite a sort of jaundiced insight into what it's like to tour. Tell us about that experience.
Well, it was supposed to be funny. You know, it wasn't supposed to be a historical and accurate document. It's just supposed to be a dry look at touring, really. It's supposed to be fun, you know. It's a strange thing to do for a living, touring by oneself and meeting different people here and there and all that sort of thing.
One of the things I liked about the book was that, unlike a lot of the rock biographies that I've read, which make it look very exciting when you're on the road, it's all sex, drugs and rock and roll and, you know, riots and everything else. His was much more what it's like to be a writer, which is that you're on your own in a strange town trying to find food after 10 o'clock at night. And you get back to your sort of bed and breakfast establishment where they've locked a door and locked you out because they forgot you're staying there. And it's bucketing with rain, and at 6 a.m. next morning you've got to get up and go to the train or bus or station or airport and do it all again.
That was one of the things I did. I tried to talk about all the tours which had been sort of solo and reasonably low down the ladder. And you don't talk about the gigs where it's a success and everyone, you get loads of encores, because it would just be dull reading, you know. I think people would rather hear about the gigs where you had to threaten a barkeep to get the fee, or, you know, when your guitar was smashed by a bear or something, you know, that sort of thing. People would rather hear about.
There is one moment in the book when it gets very close to Motley Crue's The Dirt territory, and that is when you managed to drug an old lady on a flight. And that was really funny. You give her too many sleeping pills and she's just completely zonked. Yeah. And everybody thinks that you've been trying to take advantage of her in some way.
Yeah, we had to be careful with that. We had to change a couple of the details.
In case she was identifiable.
Well, she would absolutely be identifiable. She would absolutely be identifiable.
let's just take you right back to the very beginning of your career, because I liked your reference to Windy Old Fife, and this podcast is about Scottish identity, and I thought it placed you very nicely as a wee boy from Scotland who's trying to make it in a big world. How important is Scotland to your musical identity?
The way I think I write is I look back on things which have happened. So I tour and I write about things that happen on tour, or people I used to know, that sort of thing. So obviously there's people I see in Scotland and they make it into the songs and the book. But I think if I lived in Bristol or Brighton or something, I think it'd be just the same, or if I lived in Ireland. I don't know if Scotland really does come into it. But then, of course, there's the occasional bit of language, like when the ha rolls in, which is obviously a Scottish word. So it does come in, but I don't think it's a major issue.
Ian Rebus particularly is the personification of Edinburgh for a lot of people, isn't he? Would he be the same if he came from Bristol?
No, I don't think so, because the Rebus novels are very much about the effect that the city of Edinburgh has on the people who live here, and very much about the past resonating in the present. And Edinburgh is a city with an awful lot of past. For decades, it was always looking back at the capital city it had once been, really had a chip on its shoulder about Glasgow, which was a much bigger and more vibrant city. But that all changed when the Parliament arrived here. And so Edinburgh keeps changing. Edinburgh's got all these extraordinary stories embedded in its walls and in its pavements. But also it's a place where new stories are being written. And you know, in the current climate where we don't know how close we are to full-scale independence. It's a very interesting time to be a novelist living and working in Scotland.
And you're here to launch your new novel, which is a post-Rebus novel. Where are you going now?
It's not out until October. I'm giving people a sneaky peek of it. It's actually mostly set in Fife, mostly set in Kirkcaldy, because I did a charity event over in Kirkcaldy to support the local football team, Raith Rovers, and people got the chance to be in my next book if they gave enough money. And two or three people gave quite a lot of money, and one of them had a cafe in Kirkcaldy, and he said, "I don't want to be mentioned, I want my cafe to be mentioned." A few months down the line, I thought, well, maybe it'd be easier if I just set the whole book there. And it's quite nice taking a tight group of cops, internal affairs cops from Edinburgh, and sending them over to Fife where they don't really get it. They don't really understand Fife at all. So I get to have a little dig as a Fifer at people from Edinburgh having a dig at Fife. So that's quite nice.
So James was doing a bit of an air punch over there, which, of course, you can't see on this podcast. Did you have any part to play in his move to Fife?
Yeah. Ian consults me about most of his work. I'm always the first person to read his basic drafts, his rough drafts. I mean, I have to rewrite most of them. But, you know, it's okay. He pays me well enough. So, no, of course, I didn't know anything about it. And it was a kind of a token punch in the air. Although I do like Fife, I feel a bit daft living in Fife almost all my life.
Now, can you just tell us a little bit about the literary scene that there is in Scotland? Are there any writers that we should be looking out for?
There's a whole bunch of younger crime writers, mostly enthralled to Alan Guthrie, who is a crime writer, also a bit of an editor and also a bit of an agent. He's always looking for new talent. And he's got a very keen eye and a very keen ear for what's good in new Scottish writing. I mean, I'm very excited about the stuff that's being written at the moment in Scotland by people like Denise Mina, for example. But there's a whole new generation coming along who are younger even than her, and I think of her as a young whippersnapper. So, you know, I'm sadly turning into the grand old man of Scottish crime writing, which is a shame. Scotland is such a small country that the creative community is quite small, and you do get to know each other. And so you suddenly get musicians working with artists who will paint their sleeve, and who then get the artists to come in and do some vocals, and then they approach a writer and say, "Would you write some lyrics for us?" And you start to get these amazing synergies. And one of the very exciting things, I think, about the people coming out of Fife, the Fence Collective, as it's loosely known as, which is in the northeast of Fife, around Anstruther, sort of writers working with artists, working with poets, working with musicians, working with actors, and there's an awful lot of cross-fertilisation, you know, and I think it's very good for the future of creative industries in Scotland.
Just one last question to you, James. You describe yourself as a Scottish gent, and I was trying to work out what exactly the tone of voice was in which you would say that of yourself.
Yeah, it was a bit of a fun thing. It's lovely to be here as the chorus of the first song on my first record. The publishers wanted a subtitle, if that's what it's called, just so people knew what it was. And I called it Scottish Gent, so people wouldn't buy it expecting sex and drugs and rock and roll. And they were expecting hummus and whiskey, and that's what they got.
I'm Louise Welsh, and the best audience question that I've ever had was about my first book, The Cutting Room. And a lady in Aberdeen said to me, "You seem to have a lot of antique dealers and gay people in your book. Did you have to interview a lot of antique dealers and gay people in order to write it?" I said, "No."
The best question I've ever heard was Jackie Kay speaking to a group of school children, and the first question was, "What's your favourite colour of balloon?"
Apropos of nothing, when the audience asked me, "What's the best film ever made?" I just said, "Jaws." Next.
Hi, my name's Edward Doxon. The weirdest question I've ever been asked by the audience was a woman stuck her hand in the air and said, "Hi, I've just read your first novel. I'm an actress. Can I play the part of Madeline? And will you be the part of Jasper?" And I thought, no.
Certainly, without comparison, the best question I was ever asked at a literary festival was quite recently in Australia, where an old lady stood up in the audience and asked me point blank if Julian Assange was my girlfriend. You know, I refused to comment then, and I refuse to comment now.
Is it useful to talk of Scottish literature when there's such a diverse range of work coming out of this country? What difference does landscape and shared national memory make to literature? I'm Charlotte Higgins, and to shine light on these matters, I'm joined by the literary editor of The Scotland on Sunday, Stuart Kelly, and by authors Andrew O'Hagan and John Niven. Andrew, you're about to give a talk called The Magic of Civic Memory, Making Scotlands of the Mind. What is this idea of civic memory that you're talking about?
It's a commitment of mine, I think, to the idea that in some countries, Scotland specifically, perhaps more than any of the modern nations, Scotland is a place where people feel much more concerned about what each other think of them than what the law says about them. It's not a culture run by its legislature, in my view. Common memory has a much bigger impact on how people feel about their culture. Comedy, in a sense, has a bigger place here than written law. And I think the thing that binds people, especially in cities like Glasgow and probably Edinburgh too, is this notion that we've been through things together, that the streets, the landscape, the weather, the past offers a shared narrative which those who have the language and the energy to access it feel a commonality about. It draws them together.
For my taste, that sounds a bit blood and soil, and I'm just wondering whether actually to talk about Scottish literature is useful at all. I don't know what you think about that, Stuart. It seems to me there are so many different Scotlands vying with each other. There are differences even in language and dialect. There are differences between the north and the south, lowlands, highlands, east and west. Is there a thing that binds together Scottish literature, and what is it, if it is?
I've always felt very attracted to Kundra's idea that any attempt to make nationalism a part of literature is, as he says, a small-scale terrorism. It's removing it from being part of the literary grand narrative and making it something very specific and quiet and small. And Scotland is a country which I think is more aware of its own fictive status than perhaps England is, or perhaps other parts of Europe are. We're a country which came into being through forms of fiction, and that binds together a country which is incredibly diverse. You know, there is nothing which makes Scotland Scotland in terms of religion, in terms of the rural versus the urban, in terms of the east versus the west. So that sharedness is a fictional quality that we have acceded to. And I find that incredibly liberating. I think that's what makes it not a blood and soil thing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's absolutely the case. As Stuart puts it, you know, that this is a culture, after all, which we know nothing about, before the 9th century. There is no history written before the 9th century, so we just made it up. And Stuart said, we have a fictional energy in this country, that Buchanan, Boteas, the great influential historians, were fictioneers, imagineers. They invented the notion of an ancient nobility and a great connection between Scottish people in the past, actually invented, which I think is a plus. So far from being blood and soil, it's actually opening up the possibility that we're all just making it up as we go along.
I think that what you're touching on, as a nation, Scotland tends incredibly towards self-mythology amongst its own people. Andrew and I were talking about this once. There's guys I know, the town we grew up in, who like, will work in building sites, but if you asked them to recount their life story, it'd be like a Dean Martin song. It's like, I've lived and I've strived and I've tried and I've done it my way, and it's like this incredible self-invention that goes on at any level. And also, people like Andrew who lived away from Scotland for a long time, I think you could put Scottish people together in a bar in New York and there's an incredible energy and they very quickly talk in shorthand because there is this shared history that kind of, well, unlike very few nations, I think, that happened. I mean, the cliche is you could drop down the middle of the Amazon jungle and you find a Scotsman propping the bar up there saying how much you missed Glasgow. You know, it's that kind of country.
I think it's incredibly important that we are self-aware about the fictive nature of our own country. Baudrillard's idea of the simulacrum, I think, is really important here. That he said, you know, it's not the image that conceals the truth, it's the image that conceals that there is no truth. And when I was doing my work on Scott, the thing that I found most exciting and liberating was that the people who illustrated the early editions didn't draw what was there, they drew what might have been there. And then the landowners built it to look like the illustration. We're a country that illustrated itself. And that self-awareness makes you much more fleet of foot. You're not tied to some sense of ancestral memory. You're tied to a sense of constantly reinvented memory.
So the idea of Scotland as an accretion of myth, which of course makes it a wonderful country for fiction in that way. But what makes Scottish fiction Scottish? What are its characteristics? I mean, I know Hugh McDermott talked of Caledonian anti-syzygy, the idea that Scotland was made up of sort of binaries of the idea of the joyful and the mournful.
The thing about McDermott, though, is that he was essentially having a roughhouse pub argument with his old former friend Edwin Muir. He borrowed that term, anti-syzygy, to suggest that there was the possibility of thought and feeling being united in the literature, that it was something that Edwin Muir said had gone out of Scottish literature in the 17th century, that Burns was really our last poet who wrote in the vernacular, who could write intellectually and with feeling at the same time, using the same register and the same language. McDermott, of course, was very defensive about it being suggested that Burns was the last person who did that, because he felt he did it very well himself. And that's an argument at the centre of Scottish culture. It's one of many arguments. It's a very argumentative literary culture in that way, which is one of the things I would say to you in answer to your question. What makes it a very demotically energised place for literature is that people do not have a standard English. They don't toe a polite line when it comes to culture. They don't think culture is about politeness in that way or middle class values. They think it's about expressing yourself with as much vividness and colour as possible.
Speaking as a novelist, when you come to write in the mother tongue, there's a certain energising thing that goes on. I wrote my first novel was set in Canada and America, and then the second one was in London. And when I came to write my third book, that was set in Scotland. And it was a real rush to write in the language. Yeah. And also, when I write film scripts too, and something pointed out to me the other day, there's been a sort of cameo Scottish character in every script I've done. I think a generation discovered this with Trainspotting, actually, that a book written so furiously and passionately in the tongue that turned a generation of people, that kind of rage generation who hadn't, maybe a lot of them, read a novel before. The very funny fact that something like Stephen Fry's party piece at the Groucho would be reading the toilet scene in Trainspotting in a very Oxbridge accent, but the vigour of the language still works, you know.
What's coming out of Scottish literature at the moment? What are your tips? Who are the great new Scottish writers emerging?
I'm rather concerned at the moment that we might be facing a kind of epigonic generation that wants to imitate the great writers that emerged in the 80s and 90s rather than overturn what they did. At my lowest moments, I worry that what we are going to get is just the Forsyte saga with Buckfast rather than something genuinely new. And the more I look at the people who were published in the 80s and 90s, the more I think there's writers there that we've kind of forgotten the direction they were going. Frank Kupner, a wonderful Glaswegian saga geographer, a man whose poetry is, I think, accessible and challenging in equal measure. John Aberdeen as well, you know, a guy who is rooted in the Doric, rooted in the sense that there's another Scotland outside the central belt, outside the islands. I think his last novel, Strip the Willow, it reimagined Aberdeen as Uberdeen, the situationist city, and that was exciting. That was more like what Americans are doing than what some of the younger generation here are looking at. I heard one author saying, I want to be the Irvine Welsh of Stirling. And I thought, I really want somebody to say, I want to be the Don DeLillo of Stirling.
Or Miss Charlotte Bronte of Stirling might be an even better idea.
I think the real problem is actually Scottish writers can do anything, but Scottish critics always want to chain them to home. You know, they're not allowing people to be part of the bigger conversation. It's always, what does this tell us about Scotland? What does this tell us about devolution? And, you know, I once called it auto-omphalism, you know, the idea of constantly looking at one's own navel. You know, our writers are going elsewhere and our critics want to keep them at home.
We wouldn't want to get too self-congratulatory about the internationalism of Scotland. Isn't particularly good nurturing Pakistani literature within its own borders, you'll notice, at the moment. And it's got quite a long way to go, by the way, on the subject of women's writing still in this country. I don't know that we can even begin to feel that we've done that well in representing the new voices that have come about in Scotland, that even in the last 40 years, never mind the last 10, that there's great literatures still waiting to happen in this country. Yes, it's a great place for a festival, and there have been some fascinating moves in contemporary writing, changes in the way poetry is written, a very different definition, as John said, of who the audience is for a literary novel, for any kind of novel in this country. But it's absolutely noticeable that we are still quite inward-looking and that we haven't created a platform for difference yet.
That's an interesting question. I mean, who would you say are the three leading contemporary female authors in Scotland right now?
Well, I mean, the sort of standard answer would be A.L. Kennedy, Janice Galloway and Ali Smith, all of whom have a very ambivalent relationship to being called Scottish. You know, I think one of the worst things was when Kathleen Jamie was described as the greatest 20th century Scottish woman poet, and you thought, you know, that's death by a thousand qualifications, just call her a great poet. I think there is a big question about why is there not a Scottish Zadie Smith? You know, why has the immigrant experience not been reflected in Scotland? I mean, it would be great if the next big Scottish novel was by somebody whose parents were Polish.
Yeah, so it's one of the cliches of Scottish literary discussion that, you know, and I'd probably be guilty of it myself three times a day, I would say, you know, the notion that Robert Louis Stevenson was never more Scottish than when in the rain in a swamp in Samoa writing The Weir of Hermiston. But in fact, that's only one side of an interesting coin. We can only really feel pleased, I think, when we've been able to build, as Stuart suggested, from the ground up, you know, a generation of writers speaking in voices that are entirely new to Scotland about matters political, personal and sexual, which can't be born yet by the culture in Scotland, and that's the future, possibly.
I think part of the problem there is the way in which literature is funded in Scotland. You know, we have a system through the Scottish Arts Council and now Creative Scotland where they're almost trying to fund the culture they want to happen, not see the culture that is happening. You know, the sooner that changes, the better.
I'm Richard Lee, here at the Edinburgh Festival, standing on the canvas with the rain on the roof and the thunder about to strike. And we've got Alan Bissett with us, and we're here to talk about Scottish identity. So how about you, Alan? Are you writing about Scottish things for Scottish people?
Yeah, to a certain extent I am, I think. And I can remember when I first started reading what we're calling, for the purposes of this discussion, Scottish literature, in the mid-90s when it was all kicking off. I was, you know, in my late teens, and up until that point I only read genre fiction, and then discovered Trainspotting, which it must have felt the way that people heard the Sex Pistols' first album. And then I discovered all these other authors, James Kelman, Tom Leonard, Liz Lockhead, Alan Warner, Duncan MacLean, Ali Smith. You know, it was just, it seemed like this vast rabbit hole suddenly. I wasn't even aware that Scottish literature existed before then. Scottish literature feels like something nourishing to me. And I've never felt that I was limited by it, really. And I do feel that, actually, there are a lot of people in Scotland who would like to read about things that are immediately surrounding them. And the only people that can do that are writers who were brought up here.
The text of your latest novel, Pac-Men, fizzes along with the sound of Falkirk. Did you play with how much that dialogue, how much that sound would enter into the narrator's, Alvin's, own voice?
Yeah, I think there is something about the rhythms of dialect, vernacular, speech. Every place within Scotland has a different speech rhythm, has a different vocabulary. And you can tap into that, and it does give your prose a different feel, a different texture. It doesn't just feel like the English that everybody else is writing.
More than 10 years after devolution, with political culture in Scotland diverging further away from Westminster, is the same thing happening for literary culture, Alan?
At the moment, no. I wouldn't say so. It certainly seemed to me as a reader a very particular Scottish literary culture in the 80s and 90s, which was on fire. It was radical. It was fierce. It was angry. It was creating its own separate republic that had nothing to do with the body politic taking place in London at the time or with English literature. That's how it felt to me as a reader. I would say that over the last 10 years or so, there has been a certain drift in Scottish literature towards genre fiction. Whether that's good or bad for readers isn't for me to say, really. You know, people read genre fiction because they like it. But in terms of the literary culture, it seems to have cooled. And it will come back, simply because the political climate that we're living in at the moment is awful. The country is worsening, and ordinary people are taking a hammering again. So if you're a writer, and you care even remotely about these things, they're going to find their way into your work. And what's happening in Scottish literature now at the grassroots level is the infrastructure is changing. There's a kind of DIY punk ethic that reminds me of what happened in the early 90s with Rebel Inc. and Clock Tower Press, where writers are just doing it for themselves. They're either putting stuff up to download, cutting out publishers altogether, or there are new publishers springing up who've got no money whatsoever, and they're producing really innovative fiction. And that does not seem like a coincidence to me. One of the writers who I think is going to do terrific things in future is a guy called Alan Wilson, who's been published by Cargo, based in Glasgow, run by people in their early 20s. He's just got a really raw voice that's looking at young people in Scotland, and we always need writers to come along who are actually telling us where the hands on the clock are as far as the youth of today, and that's particularly relevant given what's been happening in the country recently. I think Alan Wilson's going to be a great writer. The other is a guy called Robert Davidson, who's at the other end of the spectrum, older writer, who has written one of the best books about manual labourers I have ever read. It's up there with Germinal and The Ragged Trouser Philanthropist and The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. It's called Sightworks, and it's published by Sandstone Press. And these are both independent presses in Scotland who are finding innovative work that really deserves a wider audience.
And that's it for the last of our podcasts from the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2011. The producers were Ian Chambers and Francesca Panetta. I'm Claire Armistead. Thanks very much for listening, and we leave you with a treat, a brand new song from James Yorkston.
I find I'm struggling to keep myself out of the blue. And I hear that a dear old friend had passed, taken by the same thing that has its claws in you. But I remember times when we knew nothing but the sun upon us. I remember times when we felt nothing but the sun upon us. Lately, I find I struggle to keep myself out of the blues. And I She sang in her last days, and she sang of the love and love this way. But I remember times when we knew nothing but the sun upon us. I remember days when we knew nothing. I remember times when we felt nothing but the sun upon
great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.